This is Beyond the Ridge, the Vimy Foundation's conversational series in partnership with the National Film Board of Canada and supported by Veterans Affairs Canada. My name is Caitlin Bailey, the Vimy Foundation's Executive Director, and together we will be looking at the 1918 influenza pandemic. This episode was originally broadcast as a webinar and features Dr. Candice Bogert in conversation with Vimy Foundation program alumni Caroline Tolton. Beyond the Ridge pairs Vimy Foundation program alumni with academic experts to discuss topics linked to the First World War from a contemporary perspective. Dr. Bogert is the Cleghorn Fellow in War and Society at Wilfrid Laurier University within the Department of History and the Laurier Center for Military, Strategic, and Disarmament Studies. She completed her PhD in Medical Anthropology in 2015 within the Department of Anthropology at McMaster University, where she studied the 1918 influenza pandemic among soldiers in Canada. Caroline Tolton is a 2018 Beaverbrook Vimy Prize recipient, studying international relations and health studies at the University of Toronto. The Beaverbrook Vimy Prize takes Canadian, British, and French students on an educational journey across the historical battlefields of the First and Second World Wars in Belgium and France.
I think it's very appropriate that we're talking about the 1918 pandemic right now. With the current COVID-19 situation especially, it's interesting to learn more about the pandemic and explore its similarities and relevance to the world's current state of affairs. But before we get into the nitty-gritty details of the pandemic, let's establish what it really was. So Candice, I'll start with my first question. What was the 1918 influenza pandemic and what did it look like?
So the 1918 flu pandemic was a global outbreak of disease. So to clarify some of the terms we're hearing almost every day now, an epidemic is more cases of a particular illness than we would expect in a given place and time. And a pandemic is this, but on a much wider geographic scale. So the 1918 flu pandemic circulated the globe in three pandemic waves, beginning in the spring of 1918. And some people listening in might know it by its other name, the Spanish influenza pandemic. The 1918 flu is suspected to have killed between 60 and 100 million people around the globe in just a few months, rivaling the number of deaths caused by 4 years of total war in Europe. In Canada, it's thought that nearly 50,000 people died, which is very close to the number of fatal casualties the Canadians suffered during the Great War. So we're all familiar with influenza as a typically mild seasonal virus, but every so often influenza circulates in a pandemic form, with an average of around 40 years between pandemics, with higher mortality. So you'll perhaps remember the 2009 swine flu pandemic. The last pandemic before 1918 was the Russian influenza pandemic of 1889 and 1890. And an interesting fact is that all known strains of influenza A circulating among humans since are descendants of the 1918 influenza virus. So some scientists would say that technically it's still among us.
Wow, that is scary to think about. When I think of the 1918 pandemic, I think of its sheer scale and death toll, and it is a frightening thought to think that the virus is still around today. Candice, you also brought up the fact that the pandemic is also known as the Spanish flu. Now, that name has definitely gotten some press lately, and some people have even compared it to Donald Trump calling COVID-19 the Chinese virus. So can you tell me a bit about the name Spanish flu and how it came about?
Imagine what it's like having one of the most devastating pandemics to occur being named after your country. Spain had an open press, so the belligerent countries during the war had strict press censorship and didn't want word of illness getting out and indicating weakness to their enemies. So this meant that Spain's papers began to report cases of the emerging pandemic, and then other countries began calling it the Spanish flu. So if we look back in history, this is common during disease outbreaks. So looking at the emergence of syphilis in the Middle Ages, the French called it the German disease, the Germans called it the French disease. The pandemic before 1918 was called the Russian influenza pandemic. Mm-hmm. So we tend to skirt around the fact that diseases don't respect national borders, and people always want to think of disease as coming from the outside, from others. And it's kind of unfortunate that this Spanish name has stuck around.
It's really interesting that the virus got the name Spanish flu because of Spain's open press. I think that just goes to show just how much the pandemic was influenced by the context of World War I, since Spain was a neutral country and didn't have as much censorship. So did the virus even start in Spain at all? I've heard different stories about where and how it started, everything from Kansas to China to Spain. So what are the actual origins of the pandemic?
There's actually a lot of conflicting research on this, but one of the interesting things is that all of these different origin stories have in common their relationship to the First World War. So the first long accepted theory maintained that the virus emerged in the United States among Army recruits at Camp Funston in Kansas in March of 1918. So Camp Funston was identified retrospectively as the epicenter of the pandemic in the US by epidemiologists. And an alternative hypothesis to the United States origins theory is that the pandemic emerged at the British training camp at Etaples, France, between 1916 and 1917. So this theory is based on the clinical reports of the Royal Army Medical Corps, which described an epidemic of purulent bronchitis among recruits there. And still other scholars have proposed that the pandemic emerged in China during the winter of 1917-1918, and then spread to Europe and the rest of the world with the Chinese Labor Corps. So Canadian scholar Mark Humphreys has added his support to this theory based on archival evidence of the Chinese Labor Corps spreading flu, misdiagnosed as pneumonic plague, from China to Europe and Canada in 1918.
Wow, so which one is it? Is it Kansas, Etaples, China, or something else?
So we're not certain. So scholars have noted that without testing samples of viral materials from these contexts, all of these theories are based on circumstantial evidence. So it's possible we'll never know. But it's interesting to think about why we're so obsessed with finding the first cases. So are we trying to locate blame? What draws us to those kinds of questions? And it's also interesting to think that each community in Canada would have its own origin story for the pandemic. So, for example, within Northern Newfoundland and Labrador, in some Inuit communities, the pandemic was introduced by traders bringing supplies and coming to collect furs and goods produced in the community. So while it's not my specific research area, which is soldiers, the NFB short film, The Last Days of OCAC, directed by Anne Budgell and Nigel Markham, highlights the extraordinary circumstances at OCAC. So in the clip that Caroline is cueing right now, we can see how the community experienced the arrival of flu linked to the First World War.
Over the years, I saw a lot of hardship, but the events of November 1918 were the greatest test of the human spirit I ever experienced. That year, the last year of the Great War, we heard rumors of an influenza sickness, but we had no idea how serious it was.
The Last Days of OCAC is an excellent film, and for those of you in the audience who haven't yet watched it, I would really recommend it. And it's under half an hour, so if you ever have time to spare, be sure to check it out. A lot of public attention about the 1918 pandemic seems to be focused on cities and battlefields, but it's important to remember that the virus affected rural and indigenous communities as well. That one line from the clip we just played really resonates with me. The pandemic was referred to as the greatest test of the human spirit I ever experienced. And over again, when I hear about the pandemic, I hear about how devastating it was. So why and how did the virus spread, and what was it that made it so devastating?
Influenza spread by respiratory droplets. So one person coughing or sneezing, and then those respiratory droplets being inhaled by another individual, or through contact with the virus on surfaces. So the disease spreads rapidly in crowded quarters like schools, but also in the context of the Great War, on crowded troop trains and in military camps. Research by Sven-Erik Mamelund of Norway suggests that not everyone was equally vulnerable. So people who were impoverished, marginalized members of society, those living in crowded houses, those with tuberculosis or without access to nursing care, were the most vulnerable. And there's a couple ways to think about your question about how devastating the flu was. And it was certainly devastating in terms of the total number of the dead, and obviously for families who had lost loved ones. But if you flip the statistics around, by far more people survived than died. And estimates vary, and there's heterogeneity between places, but case fatality rates, or the proportion of people who got sick and subsequently died, is thought to be around 2.5%. So that leaves around 97.5% of those who got sick surviving.
Wow, it's nice to hear that there's a bit of a bright side in terms of mortality rates. 97.5% of people surviving seems like a pretty significant portion. At the same time, it's still tragic to think of the people who did die. One comparison I can make is, as I mentioned earlier, I traveled to Europe to study the wars through the BVP program. And one of the things I particularly remember from the experience was seeing the seemingly endless lines of gravestones belonging to soldiers who died during the First World War. And it was overwhelming to hear just how many people lost their lives in the conflict. It was around 40 million. And seeing some of the cemeteries for myself was a very emotional experience. Lines of gravestones made the death seem much more real and helped give me some semblance of the enormity of the war.
So it's the same for me, Caroline. Seeing the rows upon rows of gravestones in Normandy when I was a high school student is one of the most memorable experiences I have ever had. So I'm really thrilled to hear about your own experience with the Beaverbrook program and to think more about how these two disasters are linked in the past.
Yeah, but the really shocking thing is, and the reason I say all this, is that more people died in the 1918 flu, around 50 million, maybe more. And it's one thing to read about such a big number in a history book, but for me, the Beaverbrook program really put it into perspective. So this leads me to my next question. What influence did the Spanish flu have on the outcome of World War I?
So I love this question, Caroline. And actually, Howard Phillips, who is one of the most prominent 1918 flu scholars, has recently written that without the 1918 flu pandemic, there might not have been an Allied victory in the war. His argument is that based on the timing of the pandemic's arrival in different military forces, if the German army hadn't been stricken with flu in the fall of 1918, the Allies might not have secured an armistice when they did. But not everyone agrees, so some military historians don't believe that the flu had any impact. So you won't often see mention of flu in military histories, or sometimes it's just a very short mention.
I know some of your specific research focuses on interactions between nurses and sick soldiers. Can you tell us a bit about those interactions, and is there anything from your own research that particularly resonated with you?
Yeah, so one of the things that really stands out to me is how people went out of their way to care for each other in ways that went far above and beyond the call of duty. So for instance, when military hospitals were overwhelmed, nurses were asked to volunteer to go tend to sick soldiers in the hardest hit camps. And they did so without question. Nurses like Canadian Claire Gass, she volunteered to take care of sick soldiers at Kinmel Park in Northern Wales, one of the largest military camps there. And if you read her war diary, she talks about arriving at Kinmel Camp and surveying the military hospital and seeing such sick, sick men, many of whom she believed would die. But she didn't throw up her hands and say, "There's nothing I can do." She rolled up her sleeves, and it looks like from her diary, she didn't have time to write for days because she was working so hard to save these patients. So they really did whatever they could to help, and good nursing care was really the only treatment available. And so the fact that so many people survived is a testament to the care they received from people like these nurses.
I love that. And that's such an admirable attitude to have, not giving up, not saying there's nothing you can do, but doing everything possible to save patients' lives. And I think we see similar attitudes today with the current pandemic, and we owe a lot to our healthcare workers.
You're so right. And to add to what I was talking about, one other thing that stands out is the way that these nurses would then, after working these long shifts, spend time writing letters of condolence to the family members of soldiers who had died, just making an earnest effort to reduce the pain and suffering of those affected by the pandemic. So people really cared for each other. And you see this outside of the military as well. So one of the best examples from my students who researched the pandemic in Kitchener, Ontario, was the fact that factory owners hired nurses to go around and check on their employees and shut down their assembly lines in spite of the hit to their profits to protect their workers. And this is well before the advent of what we know as the welfare state. People volunteered to bring their neighbors food and supplies to heat their homes. And so this pandemic really highlights the idea of community and people helping each other in a time of need, which I think is something really positive we can take away from a global disaster.
That is really inspiring to hear. Thank you for sharing that. It's heartening to see that kindness and compassion can shine through even in the middle of a pandemic. And although the 1918 influenza pandemic was over 100 years ago, today, thousands of healthcare workers are working long hours and putting their lives at risk in the fight against COVID-19. So let's explore the medical treatment side a bit further then. How were Spanish flu victims treated, and what did the virus look like from a sick soldier's perspective?
The only real treatment was good nursing care, although some people did believe that whiskey was a viable treatment option. Soldiers wrote about how quickly the disease spread, how fast the military hospitals filled up, and how hard the nursing staff worked. In letters, soldiers would often minimize their own trials and tribulations so as not to cause anxiety amongst their family members at home. And it seems from some of their letters like they worried more about their families and fellow soldiers than themselves. One of the best sayings I've come across was written by a camp commandant at Niagara-on-the-Lake. When he was trying to deal with the pandemic, he said he would take help from God, man, or the devil. And military officials were exasperated. So they had a war to win, and this pandemic is threatening their ability to reinforce the strength of the army. So they really had tough choices to make: continue recruiting and potentially spread disease, or stop recruiting and not reinforce the army. So we have the benefit of hindsight, but they did not, and these were really tough choices.
That's really sweet to hear how concerned the soldiers were about their families. And I can certainly imagine military officials would be exasperated fighting a pandemic alongside a war, which is not a great situation to be in. While we luckily have no world war today, we do have a pandemic. So how does the COVID-19 coronavirus compare to the Spanish flu in terms of contagiousness and mortality rate?
So I really think that it will probably take some more time before scientists can answer this question. And I'm by no means an expert on coronaviruses. Seems to be gathering accurate data. So epidemiologists need accurate data on things like how many people have been exposed, infected, and have died. And while they're busy trying to contain the pandemic and get people tested and treated, so really working in a sort of crisis mode, it's really difficult to gather these statistics. So my guess is that we won't know until researchers have time to evaluate the situation more closely.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. It seems there's still so much we don't know about COVID-19 and we're learning as we go. But even so, as we try to stop the spread of COVID, perhaps we can gain inspiration from the past. So this brings me to my next question. How was the 1918 pandemic stopped?
Different communities had different responses. So remember in 1918, the influenza virus hadn't yet been identified. So imagine combating a pandemic when you aren't even certain of the causative agent. In Canada, there's no federal Department of Health. So public health is under municipal authority. And so the pandemic response across the country was really a patchwork of local responses. But in general, things like spitting in public are outlawed. People are encouraged to wear masks. Streetcars are sanitized. In some places, houses with infections were placarded. Public gatherings are banned, including church services and funerals. Movie theaters are also closed. Sound familiar?
Sounds very familiar. The masks, banning public gatherings, social distancing, we have all these things today. At least today, we know what the virus looks like, even if there's so much we don't know. And it's very frightening that back then they hadn't even identified the influenza virus. So right now, the virus is inflicting a particularly heavy toll on our southern neighbor, the United States, among other countries. Which country was most affected by the 1918 pandemic and why?
So I know that within countries, there are significant differences in the impact on communities. So for example, some entire communities like OCAC are hit extremely hard, whereas other communities are virtually untouched. So in fact, the experiences of the Inuit community at OCAC, which was the one we showed from the documentary clip before, so many people died there that the entire settlement is abandoned. So let's see if we can show another clip from the last days of OCAC, which you can watch on the Vimy Foundation's website.
They had been infected by Spanish influenza. After the disease had run its course, OCAC was nearly wiped out. the records of the Moravian missionaries and the recollections of the survivors tell the story of the last days of Okak.
Okak is devastated, but in some other places, communities are relatively untouched. So there's a lot of variation in terms of the effects of the virus.
Wow. It's very sad to hear how some communities, including Okak, were decimated. But at the same time, it's heartening to know that that was not the case everywhere. And the film also features interviews with survivors. And while their stories touch on a very sad topic, it is uplifting to know that the survivors were able to help preserve the memory of Okak. Like the 1918 influenza, COVID-19 has spread rapidly around the world and turned into a pandemic. So what other similarities are there between the 1918 flu and the COVID-19 virus? And what lessons can we learn from the 1918 pandemic?
So I think some of the best lessons we can take away are remembering to take care of each other. So as we've talked a little bit about, people volunteered in droves, they helped their neighbors. They've got through it together, and from what I've read in the news, we're seeing a lot of this now in efforts to take care of people who are self-isolating, appreciating frontline workers. And another lesson we can take away is to tailor our pandemic preparedness to plans to help the most vulnerable. So we know that vulnerability during a pandemic is not going to be equally spread across the board, and mitigating the risks for those who are the most vulnerable is really desirable. So for influenza, this is the immunocompromised, the elderly, pregnant women, the homeless, otherwise marginalized people. And it's really interesting to think about how a situation like the 1918 flu pandemic would play out today. And it's really hard to extrapolate because things are so different now. In 1918, many people died of secondary bacterial infections, which could be treatable now. We're also not at war, and social norms and values have changed drastically. So in 2020, we have a federal Department of Health, we have health insurance coverage, hospital care is much more widely available, whereas this kind of coverage did not exist in 1918. So things are really different now than they were.
Yeah, luckily we've definitely made some progress on the medical side of things since 1918. Your message about taking care of each other is lovely to hear. And I think it's precisely at these moments when the world is being tested, that compassion is so important. But let's move away from the global perspective for a minute and turn to Canada specifically. How did Canada respond to the 1918 pandemic, and how badly did the virus hit here at home?
So again, this really depends on your geographic, social, and economic situation. Anne Herring and Ellen Correll at McMaster University have done some really interesting research on Hamilton, Ontario, and found that mortality rates in the poorer areas of the city were significantly higher than those in wealthier areas of the city, linked to overcrowded housing, a lack of access to care, and co-circulating pathogens like tuberculosis. Anthropologists would call this a syndemic situation, where the social and economic factors exacerbate the effects of diseases within a community. So this means that it's hard to generalize about the impact of the virus across Canada, because it's so different across the country and even within cities.
All those variations with the disease must make it both difficult and very interesting to study. Now, there's talk about COVID-19 coming in multiple waves. Did the 1918 influenza come in waves? And if so, what did that look like?
So influenza pandemics typically circulate in waves. And in 1918, there were generally three waves of the pandemic, although this varied somewhat from place to place. The first wave was mild, occurring in the spring of 1918, and lots of people got sick, but very few died. And in general, people recovered very quickly. And it's interesting because this wave went largely unnoticed or unremarked upon at the time, but has been retrospectively identified by combing through public health and death records and the like.
So the first wave is largely unnoticed, but then what happens in the next wave?
So the second wave was very different from the first wave. And the second wave occurred in the fall of 1918 in Canada and was much more severe, beginning in the late summer and early fall. So it's thought that this fall wave spread to Canada with soldiers moving from the United States and then east and west across the country with soldiers mobilizing for the Siberian and Canadian Expeditionary Forces. So six soldiers were unloaded from troop transports as they moved across the country, effectively spreading disease as they went. So then these soldiers were packed into troop transports to move them overseas, and the illness again spread rapidly in these close quarters. And the third wave, which was sometimes just as deadly as the fall wave, occurred in the winter of 1918 and 19 in Canada. And some believe it could have been ignited by the armistice celebrations at the end of the war, or people congregating in crowded households during the very cold winter. And it's believed that the 1918 strain of flu continued spreading in Canada into the 1920s, especially into remote communities. So think of northern Canada. And so it's often thought of as a rapid event, but it actually occurred over months. And if you believe in the ETAP origins theory, potentially years.
Yikes, that's scary to hear. I certainly hope we can prevent a second COVID-19 wave as much as possible. But of course, that remains to be seen, especially with social distancing beginning to slowly ease up. Nowadays, there's a lot of talk about the detrimental impact COVID-19 is having on the economy, and we're in an ongoing economic recession. So I personally haven't heard too much at all about the economic impacts of the 1918 pandemic. So could you tell us a bit about what the economy looked like during and after the flu?
Yeah, so I think many people would agree with you, Caroline, that people immediately think of the period following the First World War and the pandemic as prosperous. So we immediately think of the Roaring Twenties. But the immediate aftermath of the pandemic is actually depression rather than prosperity. So economists estimate that the flu caused declines in GDP between 6 and 8% worldwide. And the depression that followed the war lasted until around 1921 in Canada. And Canada in 1919 was a year of labor disruption. So we see the return of soldiers, high rates of unemployment, and this is perhaps best crystallized during the Winnipeg General Strike, the largest strike in Canadian history, between May and June of that year. In December of 1919, enough veterans were out of work that Parliament scrambles to set up a fund to assist them, and they actually authorized an emergency fund of $50 million to deal with veterans' immediate needs, and $5 million on direct relief to those veterans. So hundreds of veterans that were out of work lined up in Toronto to receive unemployment assistance and checks. And these events foreshadowed the economic depression of the early 1920s.
That is very interesting, especially since prior to this, I really hadn't heard much at all about the negative economic impacts. I think generally when people think about the Roaring Twenties, as you said, we think of economic prosperity. So it's interesting to see that that wasn't necessarily the whole story, especially in the early 20s. So how long did it take for life to get back to normal after the influenza pandemic?
Yeah, so I suspect a lot of people are actually wondering this right now in our current situation. So research that I've read on the demographic rebound, so how quickly populations began to recover with people remarrying, having children, population recovery occurred within 5 to 10 years, and often there was a marriage boom following the pandemic. So the economy began to recover into the 1920s, and the Great Depression follows in 1929.
So while recovery took some time, it was perhaps not as long as I might have expected given the massive death toll. Speaking of death toll, I certainly hope this isn't the case, but I've got to ask, could the coronavirus kill as many people as the influenza pandemic?
So that's really a question I don't know the answer to. I certainly hope not. In 1918, Canada's population was around 8 million. So if we consider the flu and the Great War together, so 50 million deaths during the 1918 flu pandemic and another 61,000 due to the war, the total loss to the Canadian population is around 1.3% of our entire population between 1914 and 1918. So in today's numbers, with our population at around 37 million, that would be equivalent to the loss of nearly half a million people. So that would be much worse than the worst predictions released by the Canadian government. So we really hope our trajectory will be much, much more positive.
I certainly hope we don't see numbers of that scale with COVID-19. And I believe the last time I checked, Canada is only at around 81,000 cases or so. So we're thankfully far from half a million deaths at the moment, like with the influenza pandemic. And perhaps therein lies a bit of hope. People back in 1918 and 1919 faced similar challenges and faced death on an unimaginable scale, but they got through it, and so can we. So to wrap up our discussion, I study both health and history in university, and I think this is why I love both academic disciplines. History helps us learn from the past and understand change, while health helps us learn how the world can better deal with illness. Not only is the 1918 pandemic a historical topic, but it is very relevant today from a health perspective, and there are lessons we can draw from it as we battle COVID-19 and other future challenges. As Candace mentioned, the 1918 pandemic showed us just how important it is to take care of each other. As we fight COVID-19, I think it's important to remember that we're in this together. Seeing all the support for essential workers, as well as all the people volunteering and spreading hope over the past few months, has really brought home for me the fact that we're not so different from people in the past. And there are countless other lessons to be drawn from the flu pandemic, which for me is really cool. I would like to extend a huge thank you to Dr. Candace Bogart for her wonderful and very informative responses today.
I would like to thank our series partners, the National Film Board of Canada, for the short film clip from The Last Days of OCAC, and Veterans Affairs Canada for support of Beyond the Ridge, and finally, our partner for the original webinar, Defining Moments Canada. Defining Moments Canada is dedicated to recognizing key moments in Canadian history through storytelling and empowering history educators across the country. Their website contains lesson plans and historical resources, such as articles, micro-histories, and a story map about Canada and the 1918-1919 influenza pandemic, including work by our panelists today, Dr. Candace Bogart. They also have resources on the site about D-Day and VE Day and are currently developing a project to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the discovery of insulin. I hope you've enjoyed this episode and stay tuned because it is only the first in the Vimy Foundation's Beyond the Ridge series. In the next episodes, we will be looking at topics such as women and war, the environmental impact of conflict, the War Measures Act, and commemorations. Please join me again. Until next time, this is Beyond the Ridge. Beyond the Ridge is a Vimy Foundation podcast, produced in partnership with the National Film Board of Canada and supported by Veterans Affairs Canada. Building the future informed by the past, the Vimy Foundation works to preserve and promote Canada's ongoing legacy of leadership, as symbolized by the First World War victory at Vimy Ridge in April 1917, a milestone where Canada came of age and was recognized on the world stage.